Welcome to Season 5 of the Irish Baptist College podcast, Let's Talk. I'm your host, Davey Ellison. I serve as the Director of Training at the Irish Baptist College. The college, through theological education, seeks to magnify Christ, advance the gospel, and strengthen the church. And in this series of podcasts, we're talking about all things new. Over the past year, there's been lots of change in the college with lots of new beginnings and new things. And we're going to explore some of this in this series of podcasts. The hope is that what you hear will encourage you in your faith, that it might elicit further support for the college, and perhaps even tempt you to come and study with us in some way. And to help us with that today is our historical theology tutor and postgraduate director, Dr. David Luke. Great to have you with us today, yep, David.
Good to be here.
Thank you for sparing the time to be with us this afternoon. This time last year, you were not with us. You were on sabbatical, which leads into stuff that we're going to talk about in just a moment. That was your first sabbatical while working for the college?
Yeah, that's correct.
First sabbatical ever?
Second sabbatical.
Sabbatical whenever you were in pastoral ministry.
Yeah. So I had a sabbatical there after about 10 years. And now after about 10 years at the college, I had a sabbatical again. So.
And how was it?
Yeah, it was good. It was nice to be away and do
Thanks.
Something. do a couple of things are a little bit different, which was nice, and focus on a couple of different projects. So that was good. Yeah, it was a good time.
Excellent. Okay, and I can hear the listeners starting to ask the question. Well, what projects did you work on? And that is what we're going to come to now. So. One of the new things in the last year has been a couple of publications from yourself, a couple of new things appearing in print. So what are they?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things, as you say. The first is that I was invited to write an introductory essay to a republication of the Sermons of Benjamin. I'm never quite sure how to pronounce his surname.
Well, that's why I asked you the question. So you said it first, and I'm just going to copy you.
I think I've gone through various iterations of what it might be. So Benjamin Bedome. So maybe take your pick. But since he was an 18th century Baptist minister, I don't think he's likely to argue with us.
Okay, great. So that was one thing.
I wrote the essay for that. So the Pritchard Baptist Heritage Press asked me to contribute that introductory essay. They're going to republish his sermons in three volumes. So I did that. And then I was also working on a book on Jonathan Edwards and the Lord's Supper. Which was finally titled Meeting Christ at His Table, Jonathan Edwards in the Lord's Supper.
Excellent. Great. This is good. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about these publications. You're going to enlighten me. I've already been enlightened because I'd never heard of Benjamin Bedome, never heard of Ben, so I hadn't. So who is he? 18th century Baptist, you've given that much away. And why would his sermons be of help to us today? Why might it be a good thing that these are being republished for us?
Okay, Benjamin is a very interesting character. As you say, not as widely known as some other 18th century Baptists who were his contemporaries, such as Andrew Fuller, but very well known at the time, very highly thought of. Highly revered in particular Baptist circles in the 18th century. And he spent all his ministry effectively at a place called Burton-on-the-Water, which is in the Cotswolds, and a place that's often visited, a very popular kind of spot for people who are visiting the Cotswolds. But Benjamin Bedome has long since been forgotten by most visitors to Burton, Burton-on-the-Water. So I say he was a very well-known, popular figure at the time. At the outset of his ministry, there was a part during the Great Awakening, the Evangelical Revival of the 18th century, his church was greatly revived, and he went to a small church that had a history of splits and difficulties, falling out with its pastors over a long period of time. And but at the outset of his ministry, there was this season of revival. Church grew dramatically and then really stayed at that level over a number a number of years. He became a much sought-after preacher. Very often the local Baptist Association would have him come along, and he was the guest preacher, so became very well known as a preacher. Subsequently became well known a little bit in his lifetime, but more so after his death, he became known as a hymn writer. So after he had this rather unusual practice, which I don't think either you or I have developed, where when he prepared his sermon, he also then wrote a closing hymn to be sung after the sermon. So he developed this as his practice, and towards the end of his life, they began to gather his hymns. But after he died, they had the first complete collection of about 800 hymns. And many of those were popular at the time. But I suppose as practices of hymn singing come and go, they're less popular today. Still a few of them around that people sing. There are a few, I think, in Christian hymns, and the old Grace hymnal. So there are a few still around that people sing.
Yeah, I just discovered that this week, reading another book, and his name came up attached to some hymns. So
So he was certainly very well known at the time. Had a very difficult life, very very tragic life. A number of his children died comparatively young. His wife predeceased him, and those were very difficult times for him. And on one occasion, he wrote that it was much easier to preach about these things and sing about these things in your hope of the Lord than to actually practice it in the midst of difficulties. His sermon is interesting. I'm not kind of quite sure how they would go down if preached today, but certainly a very interesting read. They're very simple sermons in many ways, but I think the quality that comes across when you read through them is they're incredibly heartwarming. Very encouraging. So as I say, they're not kind of great theological treaties by any stretch of the imagination, but as I say, just very warm-hearted, devotional sermons. So I think anybody who picks them up and reads them will be encouraged just simply by reading them.
And your introductory essay is really a biographical sketch, filling out some more of that details.
Yeah,
that right?
Some more detail about him, a little bit just about the condition of Baptists in the 18th century. And the background that he ministered against, and a little bit about the Baptists in the West Country. So we tend not to think about the West Country today, but then Bristol is one of the major ports in England. A lot of activity there, a lot of activity with Baptists there historically. So it's he's in a very interesting part of the world in the 18th century.
Okay. Excellent. Great. And this is the first of three volumes, did you say?
It's the first. Yeah, this is the introductory essay in the three volumes.
Three volumes. Okay. And how big are these volumes?
Oh, that's a good question.
We're talking like a couple of hundred pages, or we're talking like 600, 700 pages? You don't know?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay. Well, you'll have to find out.
I can't remember. I think it's maybe about 250, 300 pages. If my memory serves me correctly, but I'm a little bit vague on that.
Of warmly devotional sermons. So
yeah,
we can all benefit from that.
I think anybody who's going to read them is going to come away encouraged by them.
Great. Excellent. Good. Well, it's great to hear about that. Great to have a rediscovery, if you want to call it that, somewhat forgotten figure.
He is somewhat forgotten, and it is good to kind of hear about this guy, because certainly he was very well known at the time amongst Baptist figures. And
evidently influential then as well.
Yeah, much sought after. When bigger churches became vacant, this smallish church in Burton-on-the-Water, when biggish churches became vacant, they very often, a lot of people tried to lure him away from Burton-on-the-Water. There's one incident where a guy came to plead with him to become their pastor in one of the bigger churches, I think it was in London. But one of his congregation let off the visitor's horse, so the horse ran away, and he just did this to teach this other man what it would be like to lose something he loved. If he took the pastor away, then they would lose something they loved. So, but when he didn't do that, nonetheless, people still sought him for advice. Suitable candidates for pulpits and churches if he wasn't available himself.
Excellent, super. It's a little bit harder to say that about the next figure that you've written on. Jonathan Edwards is obviously a lot better known than Benjamin I'm going to go with Better Me. I think that sounds good. So,
well, I'm kind of with Bedome at the minute. But,
And Jonathan Edwards is obviously, he's loomed large on your horizon throughout your doctoral studies and then a series of publications after that. What keeps you interested in Jonathan Edwards and his work?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me this, so it did make me think a little bit, how did I get into Edwards in the first place? And it was a slightly circuitous route, really, that probably... Oh, I'm sure over 30 years ago I read a book that contained a little excerpt in it about Edwards' life, and I thought I'd read this to you, maybe enlighten you a little bit about what intrigued me first about Edwards. So it was this little snippet about from his diary, where he said, "Once as I rode out into the woods for my health in 1737, having alighted from my horse in a retired place, as my manner commonly has been to walk for divine contemplation and prayer, I had a view that for me was extraordinary of the glory of the Son of God as mediator between God and man, and his wonderful, great, full, pure, and sweet grace and love and meek, gentle condescension. This grace that appeared so calm and sweet appeared so great above the heavens. The person of Christ appeared ineffably excellent, with an excellency great enough to swallow up all thought and conception, which continued as near as I can judge about an hour, which kept me the greater part of the time in a flood of tears and weeping aloud. I felt an ardency of soul to be what I know not otherwise how to express, emptied and annihilated, to lie in the dust, and to be full of Christ alone, to love him, to serve and follow him, and to be perfectly sanctified and made pure with a divine and a heavenly purity. I have several other times had views very much of the same nature, which have had the same effects." So when I read that, I was totally captivated by this man and this experience that that he had had, and really made me, you know, really, really interested in who he was. And but I knew very, very little about him, and in my sort of innocence and naivety, didn't really know how to find out anything more about him. So I then started to read over the years the writings of John Piper. He was a guy who came back to Edwards a few times. I got to find out a little bit more. I'll do a bit of name dropping here if it's okay. And I once met John Piper and said to him, "Dr. Piper, you really got me into Jonathan Edwards." And he said, "I'll take the blame for that." So that got me started. I then bought a book by Edwards and found it almost incomprehensible. So it must have taken me about 3 years to read it. I kept picking it up and putting it down, picking it up, rereading bits again. But eventually I made my way through it, and that's really what began to get me hooked, I think, really beginning to understand his thought a little bit more to develop with that. I then moved on to my doctoral studies, and a few ideas floating about, and the one I seemed to land on then worked around Jonathan Edwards, and at that point then I really began to get into studying him, thinking about him, understanding the way his theology worked, and again coming back to this type of, you know, real sense he had of the beauty and the majesty and the glory of God, and especially as that is revealed in Christ. And say that's something just keeps drawing me back in again. These kind of grand visions that he has of God and the whole matter of salvation and the sense of wonder that comes there. I also like his ability to work his way through ideas, and maybe not quite to the point of exhaustion, but certainly he works some ideas pretty hard and evaluates them, and that's very, very intriguing. I've read a few of his sermons on hell, and the thing that's really struck me about it is he doesn't say anything that would leave you with a sense of, if you like, the terrors of hell, but the relentless logic of what he says about hell, for example, is incredibly penetrating, and it really does make you sit up and think about this. You know, so that kind of penetrating logic, I think, really appeals to me as well.
Okay. Excellent. Good. That's really helpful and gives us a good insight into that. And obviously then, so this is your new publication, Meeting Christ at His Table, Jonathan Edwards and the Lord's Supper. So this is the book that has gone live this year. Now, we're always told never to judge a book by its cover, but we do.
Yeah.
And and lots of contemporary publications are very colourful. There's a simplicity to this cover, but I'm led to believe that there's a significance to the simplicity. So maybe you can explain, we'll commit the cardinal sin of judging a book by its cover, and then we'll talk about the contents, but maybe you can explain the significance just of the simplicity.
The cover is designed by my very good friend, David Middleton. We've been friends for about 40 years, so it was real pleasure for me to be able to involve him in the production of the book. So an architect by training, but a very gifted artist and illustrator as well. So it was good to involve him. But he asked me for a steer. I wasn't really much, I think, of being able to give him a steer, having zero artistic abilities myself. So we come back with this idea. So if you look at the cover, obviously in the foreground is Edwards, the bread and the wine from the communion. But in the background is actually the setup of his study and what his study would have looked like. And he settled on the kind of doing a line drawing rather than a colour one because he wanted to indicate the simplicity of the world in which Edwards lived. And that's kind of one of the intriguing things about Edwards' world. Doug Lesweeney, who's given an endorsement for the book, there's two guys, him and Kenneth Minkema, who are kind of the Ronaldo and Messi of Edwards studies. Doug Sweeney said that one of those striking things, if we were suddenly transported into Edwards' world, would be the silence. This is a world without noise, unlike the world that we're used to. So I think, again, just back to that kind of simplicity. And again, the drawing is an attempt to reflect the simplicity of the world in which Edwards lived and ministered.
And whenever you pause and have a look at it and think about it, it is such a striking contrast in terms of simplicity, and it does give that aura of another world, which is really good. So we appreciate that. You talk about Edwards and the Lord's Supper. So why write on that in particular, Edwards and the Lord's Supper? And maybe you can give us some, maybe you don't want to give away all the answers, but what would we learn from reading it? Maybe you can tease us into getting a copy and on that front. But
yeah, I must admit there's a little bit of a mystery in my mind as to how I ended up writing about Edwards and the Lord's Supper. Not too sure. I was working on another essay at the time on Edwards and conversion for a different publication, and when I was thinking about that, I began to think a little bit about the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is something I've thought about quite a bit over the years, and part of the reason for that was whenever I ended my came to the end of my pastoral ministry, I preached a little series of sermons on the Lord's Supper. And it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, after 15 years in the church, that I'd never actually taught about the Lord's Supper, something we did every week. But something I'd never actually taught about. And it began to occur to me that probably a lot of what we think about the Lord's Supper is actually assumed by us rather than something that we have, something that we've taught. I remember asking at the time, had anybody in the congregation ever heard anyone teaching about the Lord's Supper? And with one elderly gentleman who said he thought he'd heard a sermon once, you know, so it's perhaps not something we teach a lot about. So it did get me to begin to think a little bit more about the Lord's Supper. And I suppose the studying Edwards and the Lord's Supper then became a little bit of a lens through which to think about the Lord's Supper and our practice.
Okay, excellent. So what we'll learn is we'll think about something that we do every week and maybe don't think about enough, which is telling.
And I think that, you know, the book maybe fills a kind of a dual purpose, I think, in that regard. It is a bit of an academic study on one level, and hopefully makes a contribution to our kind of wider reading of Edwards and understanding him. So hopefully it feeds in at that level. But a lot of people who aren't Edwards scholars have said to me, well, could I read it? And I said, I'm sure you could. So I've kind of been quite gratified, I think, by a few people who've read it and said they've enjoyed it.
Good.
And it has made them think about the Lord's Supper. And I think that's the other level that I wanted to operate on, that it's something that people can read and hopefully begins to make them think a little bit about the Lord's Supper. May not end up agreeing with Edwards on everything at the Lord's Supper. I don't agree with him on everything about the Lord's Supper, but certainly I think it makes us all think, well, if they don't agree with that, what do we think? So I think there's that element to it.
Definitely. Well, let me ask two further questions. Yeah. One on that academic argument world, and then maybe one kind of relating to a more practical benefit of the book. So I think, I'm not an Edwards scholar, but my reading of the situation is that the impression is that Edwards changed his view on the Lord's Supper, at least that's how it's presented maybe in the literature and as people reflect on it. But your suggestion is that he was finally following through on the practical implications of his own long-term theological convictions. You set that up right at the beginning of the book. So what were his convictions, and then what practical implications did those convictions demand?
I sort of feel a little bit like a politician here, where I might answer my own question instead.
Well, go for it.
in that regard, he inherited a view of the Lord's Supper which was very, very distinctive, even in his world.
Okay.
He became his grandfather's assistant, and his grandfather had treated the Lord's Supper as a converting ordinance. So he believed that people who were baptized as infants and became part of the covenant community, they therefore had the right to attend the Lord's Supper if they believed the basic doctrines of the church and if they weren't living scandalous lives. And he believed that by attending the Lord's Supper, they might then become converted through participating in that. So Edwards inherited this view, and effectively for, Mads is never very good at this point, but upwards of 20 years, really, he went along with that practice within the church. I don't think we ever come across anyone who is actually converted as a result of attending the supper, either under Stoddard or Edwards. So I don't think we ever see it effectively work in that way, but he keeps that going. But I think once you begin to drill down into his writings in the Lord's Supper from the very earliest times, really, he could never have been consistently happy with that particular view of the Lord's Supper. So he thought of the Lord's Supper as a memorial feast where we remember that Christ died for us and delivered us from our sins. So we do think of him, and he talks, as many people of that era do, talking about that memorial as being something very affecting. But again, if someone's not a Christian, well, then you struggle to understand, well, how can they then be affected by this vision of the Christ who has died for them?
He then
talks about the Lord's Supper as a covenant seal, where God seals his covenant promises to us and we claim them again. But again, if a person has not been converted, well, then they cannot seal the covenant on their own behalf. He talks about the Lord's Supper then as a means of spiritual nourishment, for the nourishment of believers. Again, if you're not a believer, you're not going to be spiritually nourished by the Lord's Supper. And again, he talks about it as a means of communion between Christians and between God and us. So again, if we're not Christians, it's difficult to conceive how we're having communion with the God whom we do not know. So I think that really, yes, he carries on for whatever reason. Let's say that goes on until about from 1729 to about 1745 or so, and then he slowly begins to move in his thinking about the practice of the Lord's Supper. And part of that, I think, is really coming to terms with the fact that he's looking at the church and he sees so many people in it who are maybe unregenerate. And that makes him think again about how can people celebrate the Lord's Supper and not be not be regenerate. So I think that's the general trajectory of where he goes, and then he has the temerity to make this public, and that's the beginning of a slow end for him, actually a pretty swift end for him.
Great. Well, that's really helpful, and obviously you fill out that trajectory and that thinking a little bit in the book. The reality is that the majority of our listeners are not Edwards scholars, and some of that might be a bit lost on them. So can you sell your book to us who are not Edwards scholars in one line? You know, you've alluded a little bit to the kind of practical benefit that this book is. Go for it.
Yeah, I'm very tempted to say, I'm not saying you have to be a Christian or you're not a Christian if you haven't read this book, but, you know, why take a chance? So that's the temptation. But no, as I say, I think it always is with historical studies. It does provide us, I think, with a lens through which to look at our own culture, our own practice. Let's say it's not that we're necessarily going to end up saying, yes, well, you know,
Edwards got it all right.
He got it all right. But, you know, I think it does give us that lens to think about our own understanding, our own practice. But also there's very rich theology there of the supper as well. And again, I think that is something that, you know, we could all benefit from.
Even just to reflect on that.
Just to reflect on the kind of ideas that that he's thinking about. And again, very often as Irish Baptists, we're very keen memorialists. And, you know, Edwards had a strong memorialist understanding of the Lord's Supper, but it was a very engaged one that ought to raise our affections, strengthen our love for Christ, you know. So again, it's not a bare sign, it's not a bare memorial. And again, even if we end up saying, yes, we're still memorialists, you know, it makes us think a little bit more about what that looks like and what that means.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Meeting Christ at His Table, Jonathan Edwards and the Lord's Supper, by David Luke, and published by the Jonathan Edwards Society Press. So thank you for that. And I want to encourage our listeners to pick up a copy, to read it, and to be blessed and benefit from just wrestling with a topic that I don't think many of us have heard a lot of teaching on. And so that's useful. And I have to confess, I've not read all of it. I've flicked through some of it. But I appreciate so much the clarity with which you write on something that's a little bit alien to me. So there's my endorsement. I do plan to read the entirety of it soon. So thank you, David, so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
No problem. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. We're so glad that you do listen to the Irish Baptist College podcast. Let me just reiterate again that we are committed to training men and women for gospel service both here in Ireland and across the globe. And if you want to explore the opportunities of studying at the Irish Baptist College, a college where we are academically rigorous but vocationally focused, then I want to point you to our website, irishbaptistcollege.org. There you'll find all the information you need about the courses on offer. You'll also find on our events page some of the upcoming open events and all the other information that's necessary. Thank you so much for joining us on this season of the podcast, and we hope to be back soon with a new season. Thank you.